economics requires learning not only about how markets work, but also about market failures and the myriad ways in which governments can help markets work better. When economists misbehave, the flexible, contextual nature of economics is both its strength and its weakness. The downside was an ample display during the build-up to the global financial crisis and its aftermath. As the world economy tumbled off the edge of a precipice, critics of the economics profession rightly raised questions about its complicity in the crisis. It was economists who had legitimized and popularized the view that unfettered finance was a boon to society. They had spoken with near unanimity when it came to the dangers of government overregulation. Their technical expertise, or what seemed like it at the time, had given them a privileged position as opinion makers, as well as access to the corridors of power. Very few among them had raised alarm bells about the crisis to come. Robert Shiller was one such Cassandra. Perhaps worse, the profession failed to provide helpful guidance in steering the world economy out of its mess. Economists' opinion on monetary, fiscal, and regulatory remedies for longer-term recovery and growth never converged. Many outsiders concluded that economics was in need of a major shake-up. Burn the textbooks and rewrite them from scratch, they said. The paradox is that macroeconomics and finance did not lack the tools needed to understand how the crisis arose and unfolded. In fact, without recourse to the economists' toolkit, we cannot even begin to make sense of the crisis. What, for example, is the link between China's decision to accumulate large amounts of foreign reserves and a mortgage lender in California taking excessive risks? It is impossible to decipher such interrelationships without relying on elements from behavioral economics, agency theory, information economics, and international economics. The academic literature is chock full of models of financial bubbles, asymmetric information, incentive distortions, self-fulfilling crises, and systemic risk. Pretty much everything needed to explain the crisis and its aftermath was in the research journals. But in the years leading up to the crisis, many economists downplayed these models' lessons in favor of models of efficient and self-correcting markets, which resulted in inadequate government oversight over financial markets. There was too much Fama, not enough Shiller. Economics is a science of thinking in terms of models, Keynes once said, joined to the art of choosing models which are relevant. It was the art that fell short in this instance. Economists and those who listened to them became overconfident in their preferred models of the moment. Markets are efficient. Financial innovation transfers risk to those best able to bear it. Self-regulation works best, and government intervention is ineffective and harmful. They forgot that there were many other models that led in radically different directions. Hubris creates blind spots. The science of the profession was fine. Its craft and sociology, not so much. Economists and the public. Non-economists tend to think of economics as a discipline that idolizes markets and a narrow concept of allocative efficiency at the expense of ethics or social concerns. If the only economics course you take is the typical introductory survey, or if you are a journalist asking an economist for a quick opinion on a policy issue, that is indeed what you will encounter. But take a few more economics courses or spend some time in advanced seminar rooms and you will get a different picture. Economists get stuck with the charge of being narrowly ideological because they are their own worst enemy when it comes to applying their theories to the real world. Instead of communicating the full panoply of perspectives that their discipline offers, they display excessive confidence in particular remedies, often those that best accord with their own personal ideologies. In my book, The Globalization Paradox, I contemplate the following thought experiment. Let a journalist call an economics professor for his view on whether free trade with country X or Y is a good idea. We can be fairly certain that the economist, like the vast majority of the profession, will be enthusiastic in his support of free trade. Now, let the reporter go undercover as a student in the professor's advanced graduate seminar on international trade theory. Let him pose the same question. Is free trade good? I doubt that the answer will come as quickly and be as succinct this time around. In fact, the professor is likely to be stymied by the question. What do you mean by good? He will ask. And good for whom? The professor will then launch into a long and tortured exegesis that will ultimately culminate in a heavily hedged statement. So, if the long list of conditions I have just described are satisfied, and assuming we can tax the beneficiaries to compensate the losers, freer trade has the potential to increase everyone's well-being. If he were in an expansive mood, the professor might add that the effect of free trade on an economy's growth rate is not clear either, and depends on an altogether different set of requirements. A direct, unqualified assertion about the benefits of free trade has now been transformed into a statement adorned by all kinds of ifs and buts. Oddly, the knowledge that the professor willingly imparts with great pride to his advanced students is deemed to be inappropriate or dangerous for the general public. This is particularly true of the effects of trade on income distribution, which economists elaborate at great length in their academic studies, but tend to stay away from in public. Economists ignore the impact of the manner in which they frame their theories in introductory courses. I was invited once by two Harvard colleagues to make a guest appearance in their course on globalization. I have to tell you, one of them warned me beforehand, this is a pretty pro-globalization crowd. In the very first meeting, he had asked the students how many of them preferred free trade to import restrictions. Even though this was before the students had been instructed in the wonders of comparative advantage, the response was more than 90%. We know that when the same question is asked in real surveys with representative samples, not just Harvard students, the outcome is quite different. In the United States, respondents favor trade restrictions by a 2-to-1 margin. But the Harvard students' response was not entirely surprising. Highly skilled and better educated respondents tend to be considerably more pro-free trade than blue-collar workers are. Perhaps the Harvard students were simply voting with their own future wallets in mind. Or maybe they did not understand how trade really works. When I met with them, I posed the same question in a different way, emphasizing the distributional effects of trade. This time, the free trade consensus evaporated, even more rapidly than I had anticipated. I began the class by asking students whether they would approve of me carrying out a particular magic experiment. I picked two volunteers, Nicholas and John, and told them that I was capable of making $200 disappear from Nicholas's bank account, poof, while adding $300 to John's. This feat of social engineering would leave the class as a whole better off by $100. Would they allow me to carry out this magic trick? Only a tiny minority voted affirmatively. Many were uncertain. Even more opposed the change. Clearly, the students were uncomfortable about condoning a significant redistribution of income, even if the economic pie grew as a result. How is it possible, I asked, that almost all of them had instinctively favored free trade, which entails a similar, in fact most likely greater, redistribution from losers to winners? They appeared taken aback. Let's assume, I said next, that Nicholas and John own two small firms that compete with each other. Suppose that John got richer by $300 because he worked harder, saved and invested more, and created better products, driving Nicholas out of business and causing him a loss of $200. How many of the students now approved of the change? This time a vast majority did. In fact, everyone except Nicholas approved. I posed other hypotheticals, now directly related to international trade. Suppose John had driven Nicholas out of business by importing higher quality inputs from Germany, by outsourcing to China, where labor rights are not well protected, by hiring child workers in Indonesia. Support for the proposed change dropped with each one of these alternatives. But what about technological innovation, which, like trade, often leaves some people worse off? Here, few students would condone blocking technological progress. Banning the light bulb because candle makers would lose their jobs strikes almost everyone as a silly idea. So the students were not necessarily against redistribution. They were against certain kinds of redistribution. Like most of us, they care about procedural fairness. To pass judgment on redistributive outcomes, we need to know about the circumstances that cause them. We do not begrudge Bill Gates or Warren Buffett their billions, even if some of their rivals have suffered along the way, presumably because they and their competitors operate according to the same ground rules and face pretty much the same opportunities and obstacles. We would think differently if Gates and Buffett had enriched themselves not through perspiration and inspiration, but by cheating, breaking labor laws, ravaging the environment, or taking advantage of government subsidies abroad. If we do not condone redistribution that violates widely shared moral codes at home, why should we accept it, just because it involves transactions across political borders? Similarly, when we expect redistributive efforts to even out in the long run, so that everyone eventually comes out ahead, we are more likely to overlook reshufflings of income. That is a key reason why we believe that technological progress should run its course, despite its short-run destructive effects on some. When, on the other hand, the forces of trade repeatedly hit the same people, less educated, blue-collar workers, we may feel less sanguine about globalization. Too many economists are tone-deaf to such distinctions. They are prone to attribute concerns about globalization to crass protectionist motives or ignorance, even when there are genuine ethical issues at stake. By ignoring the fact that international trade sometimes, certainly not always, involves redistributive outcomes that we would consider problematic at home, they fail to engage the public debate properly. They also miss the opportunity to mount a more robust defense of trade when ethical concerns are less warranted. Economics instruction suffers from the same problem. In their zeal to display the profession's crown jewels in untarnished form, market efficiency, the invisible hand, comparative advantage, economists skip over the real-world complications and nuances. It is as if introductory physics courses assumed a world without gravity, because everything becomes so much simpler that way. Downplaying the diversity of intellectual frameworks within their own discipline does not make economists better analysts of the real world, nor does it make them more popular. Consider how economists have used their models in recent trade policy debates. Economists and the trade numbers game. The Trans-Pacific Partnership, a mega trade deal covering 12 countries that together produce more than a third of global GDP and a quarter of the world's exports, has been the latest battleground in the decades-long confrontation between proponents and opponents of trade agreements. True to form, the pact's advocates have marshaled quantitative models that make the agreement look like a no-brainer. Their favorite model, developed by Peter Petrie and Michael Plummer from Brandeis and Johns Hopkins Universities, respectively, building on a long line of similar frameworks by them and others, predicts increases in real incomes down the line that range from 0.5% for the United States to 8% in Vietnam, at relatively insignificant cost to employment in affected industries. TPP opponents latched onto a competing model that generates very different projections. This model, produced by Jeronim Capaldo of Tufts University and Alex Izurieta of the UN Conference on Trade and Development, along with Jomo Kwame Sundaram, a former UN Assistant Secretary General, predicts wage cuts and increased unemployment all around, as well as income declines in two key countries, the United States and Japan. There is no disagreement between the models on the trade effects. In fact, Capaldo and his collaborators take as their starting point the trade predictions from an earlier version of the Petrie-Plummer study. The differences arise largely from contrasting assumptions about how economies respond to changes in trade volumes sparked by liberalization. Petrie and Plummer assume sufficiently flexible labor markets so that job losses in adversely affected parts of the economy are compensated by job gains elsewhere. Unemployment is ruled out at the get-go. Proponents of TPP often fudged that this is an outcome that is built into the model. The Peterson Institute, which published the underlying study, inexplicably stated in its brief, "The agreement will raise U.S. wages, but is not projected to change U.S. employment levels." The result on wages is a conclusion of the study, whereas the employment projection might as well have been made before the computer crunched a single number. Capaldo and his collaborators meanwhile projected a competitive race to the bottom in labor markets, with a decline in wages and government spending keeping the lid down on aggregate demand and employment. Unfortunately, their paper does a poor job of explaining how their model works, and the particulars of their simulation are somewhat murky. The Petrie-Plummer model is squarely rooted in decades of academic trade modeling, which makes a sharp distinction between effects that are microeconomic, that shape resource allocation across sectors, and those that are macroeconomic, that relate to overall levels of demand and employment. In this tradition, trade liberalization is a microeconomic shock that affects the composition of employment, but not its overall level. Trade economists tend to analyze trade agreements in such terms, which renders the Petrie-Plummer model more congenial to them. By comparison, the Capaldo framework lacks sectoral and country detail. Its behavioral assumptions remain opaque, and its extreme Keynesian assumptions sit ill at ease with its medium-term perspective. The trouble is that the real world has not lined up so neatly with trade economists' presumptions. Trade critics have marshaled countless anecdotes about the adverse effects of imports on wages and employment in affected communities. The empirical work of three academic economists, David Autor, David Dorn, and Gordon Hansen, shows that critics have more than a point. They document that the expansion of Chinese imports has produced substantial adjustment costs and distributional consequences in the United States. In regions hit hard by imports from China, wages have remained depressed and unemployment levels elevated for more than a decade. In industries that came under Chinese competition, employment has fallen, which was expected. But there have been no offsetting employment gains in other industries, which is a surprise. Trade advocates have long maintained that deindustrialization and loss of low-skilled jobs in advanced economies have little to do with trade and are the product of new technologies rather than growing international trade. In the debate on TPP, many prominent proponents still clung to this line. In light of the new empirical findings, such nonchalance toward trade has become untenable. Incidentally, the Petrie-Plummer model does indicate that TPP will accelerate the movement of jobs from manufacturing to services, a result that the pact's advocates do not trumpet. Economists do not fully understand why expanded trade has interacted with the macroeconomy to produce the negative consequences for wages and employment that it has. We do not yet have a good alternative framework to replace the kind that trade advocates use. But we should not act as if our cherished standard model has not been severely tarnished by reality. It would be far better to consider the full range of possibilities highlighted by all models on offer, instead of putting all the weight on a single one. The uncertainties do not end with macroeconomic interactions. The Petrie-Plummer study predicts that the bulk of the economic benefits of TPP will come from reductions in non-tariff barriers, such as regulatory barriers on imported services, and lower obstacles to foreign investment. But the modeling of these effects is an order of magnitude more difficult than in the case of tariff reductions. The assumptions needed to do so are not standard and require many arbitrary shortcuts. The bottom line is that neither side's models generate numbers reliable enough on which a case for or against TPP could be made. Just about the only thing we can say with some certainty is that there would have been gainers and losers. Perhaps the agreement would have galvanized investment and knowledge flows across the Pacific, giving the world economy a much-needed boost. Perhaps not. But those who believe that the trade agreement, like previous ones, would have provided lopsided benefits, had ample reason to be concerned. Economists and Democracy. By the time my book, The Globalization Paradox, was published in 2011, I was used to all types of comments from audiences to whom I'd present the book. But at one book launch event, an economist assigned to discuss the book surprised me with an unexpected criticism. "Roderick wants to make the world safe for politicians," he huffed. Lest the message be lost, he then illustrated his point by reminding the audience of the former Japanese Minister of Agriculture who argued that Japan could not import beef because human intestines are longer in Japan than in other countries. The comment drew a few chuckles. Who doesn't enjoy a joke at the expense of politicians? But the remark had a more serious purpose, and was evidently intended to expose a fundamental flaw in my argument. My discussant found it self-evident that allowing politicians greater room for maneuver was a cockamamie idea, and he assumed that the audience would concur. Remove constraints on what politicians can do, he implied, and all you will get are silly interventions that throttle markets and stall the engine of economic growth. This criticism reflects a serious misunderstanding of how markets really function. Raised on textbooks that obscure the role of institutions, economists often imagine that markets arise on their own, with no help from purposeful collective action. Adam Smith may have been right that the propensity to truck, barter, and exchange is innate to humans, but a wide array of non-market institutions is needed to capitalize on this propensity. Consider all that is required. Modern markets need an infrastructure of transport, logistics, and communication, much of it the result of public investment. They need systems of contract enforcement and property rights protection. They need regulations to ensure that consumers make informed decisions, externalities are internalized, and market power is not abused. They need central banks and fiscal institutions to avert financial panics and moderate business cycles. They need social protections and safety nets to legitimize distributional outcomes. Well-functioning markets are always embedded within broader mechanisms of collective governance. That is why the world's wealthier economies, those with the most productive market systems, also have large public sectors. Once we recognize that markets require rules, we must next ask, who writes those rules? Economists who denigrate the value of democracy sometimes talk as if the alternative to democratic governance is decision-making by high-minded Platonic philosopher kings, ideally economists. This scenario is neither relevant nor desirable. For one thing, the lower the political system's transparency, representativeness, and accountability, the more likely it is that special interests will hijack the rules. Of course, democracies can be captured, too. But they are still our best safeguard against arbitrary rule. Moreover, rulemaking is rarely about efficiency alone. It may entail trading off competing social objectives, such as stability versus innovation, or making distributional choices. These are not tasks that we would want to entrust to economists, who might be authorities on the price of a lot of things, but not necessarily their value. True, the quality of democratic governance can sometimes be augmented by reducing the discretion of elected representatives. As we saw in the previous chapter, well-functioning democracies often delegate rulemaking power to quasi-independent bodies. When the issues at hand are technical and do not raise distributional concerns, when log rolling would otherwise result in suboptimal outcomes for all, or when policies are subject to myopia with heavy discounting of future costs. Interdependent central banks provide an important illustration of this. It may be up to elected politicians to determine the inflation target, but the means deployed to achieve that target are left to the technocrats at the central bank. Even then, central banks typically remain accountable to politicians and must provide an accounting when they miss the targets. Similarly, there can be useful instances of democratic delegation to international organizations. Global agreements to cap tariff rates or reduce toxic emissions are indeed valuable. But economists have a tendency to idolize such constraints without sufficiently scrutinizing the politics that produce them. It is one thing to advocate external restraints that enhance the quality of democratic deliberation, by preventing short-termism or demanding transparency, for example. It is another matter altogether to subvert democracy by privileging particular interests over others. For instance, we know that the global capital adequacy requirements produced by the Basel Committee reflect overwhelmingly the influence of large banks. If the regulations were to be written by economists and finance experts, they would be far more stringent. Alternatively, if the rules were left to domestic political processes, there could be more countervailing pressure from opposing stakeholders, even though financial interests are powerful at home, too. Similarly, despite the rhetoric, many World Trade Organization agreements are the result not of the pursuit of global economic well-being, but the lobbying power of multinationals seeking profit-making opportunities. International rules on patents and copyright reflect the ability of pharmaceutical companies and Hollywood, to take just two examples, to get their way. These rules are widely derided by economists for having imposed inappropriate constraints on developing economies' ability to access cheap pharmaceuticals or technological opportunities. So the choice between democratic discretion at home and external restraint is not always a choice between good and bad policies. Even when the domestic political process works poorly, there is no guarantee that global institutions will work any better. Often the choice is between yielding to domestic rent seekers or to foreign ones. In the former case, at least the rents stay at home. Ultimately, the question concerns whom we empower to make the rules that markets require. The unavoidable reality of our global economy is that the principal locus of legitimate democratic accountability still resides within the nation-state. So, I readily plead guilty to my economist critic's charge. I do want to make the world safe for democratic politicians. And frankly, I wonder about those who do not. Milton Friedman's Magical Thinking. Probably no other economist since Keynes has had as much impact on policymakers' understanding of how economies work as Milton Friedman. Friedman was one of the 20th century's leading economists, a Nobel Prize winner who made notable contributions to monetary policy and consumption theory. But he will be remembered primarily as the visionary who provided the intellectual firepower for free market enthusiasts during the second half of the century, and as the eminence grise behind the dramatic shift in the economic policies that took place after 1980. At a time when skepticism about markets ran rampant, Friedman explained, in clear, accessible language, that private enterprise is the foundation of economic prosperity. All successful economies are built on thrift, hard work, and individual initiative. He railed against government regulations that encumber entrepreneurship and restrict markets. What Adam Smith was to the 18th century, Milton Friedman was to the 20th. As Friedman's landmark television series, Free to Choose, was being broadcast in 1980, the world economy stood in the throes of a singular transformation. Inspired by Friedman's ideas, Ronald Reagan, Margaret Thatcher, and many other government leaders began to dismantle the government restrictions and regulations that had been built up over the preceding decades. China moved away from central planning and allowed markets to flourish, first in agricultural products and eventually in industrial goods. Latin America sharply reduced its trade barriers and privatized its state-owned firms. When the Berlin Wall fell in 1989, there was no doubt as to which direction the former command economies would take, toward free markets. But Friedman also produced a less felicitous legacy. In his zeal to promote the power of markets, he drew too sharp a distinction between the market and the state. In effect, he presented government as the enemy of the market. He therefore blinded us to the evident reality that all successful economies are, in fact, mixed. Unfortunately, the world economy is still contending with that blindness in the aftermath of a financial crisis that resulted in no small part from letting financial markets run too free. The Friedmanite perspective greatly underestimates the institutional prerequisites of markets. Let the government simply enforce property rights and contracts, and presto, markets can work their magic. In fact, the kind of markets that modern economies need are not self-creating, self-regulating, self-stabilizing, or self-legitimizing. Governments must invest in transport and communication networks, counteract asymmetric information, externalities, and unequal bargaining power, moderate financial panics and recessions, and respond to popular demands for safety nets and social insurance. Markets are the essence of a market economy in the same sense that lemons are the essence of lemonade. Pure lemon juice is barely drinkable. To make good lemonade, you need to mix it with water and sugar. Of course, if you put too much water in the mix, you ruin the lemonade, just as too much government meddling can make markets dysfunctional. The trick is not to discard the water and the sugar, but to get the proportions right. Hong Kong, which Friedman held up as the exemplar of a free market society, remains the exception to the mixed economy rule, and even there the government has played a large role in providing land for housing. The image most people will retain of Friedman is the smiling, diminutive, unassuming professor holding up a pencil in front of the cameras in Free to Choose to illustrate the power of markets. It took thousands of people all over the world to make this pencil, Friedman said, to mine the graphite, cut the wood, assemble the components, and market the final product. No single central authority coordinated their actions. That feat was accomplished by the magic of free markets and the price system. Nearly 40 years later, there is an interesting coda to the pencil story, which in fact was based on an article by the economist Leonard E. Reed. Today, most of the world's pencils are produced in China, an economy that is a peculiar mix of private entrepreneurship and state direction. A modern-day Friedman might want to ask how China has come to dominate the pencil industry, as it has so many others. There are better sources of graphite in Mexico and South Korea. Forest reserves are more plentiful in Indonesia and Brazil. Germany and the United States have better technology. China has lots of low-cost labor, but so does Bangladesh, Ethiopia, and many other populous low-income countries. Undoubtedly, most of the credit belongs to the initiative and hard work of Chinese entrepreneurs and laborers. But the present-day pencil story would be incomplete without citing China's state-owned firms, which made the initial investments in technology and labor training, forest management policies, which kept wood artificially cheap, generous export subsidies, and government intervention in currency markets, which gives Chinese producers a significant cost advantage. China's government has subsidized, protected, and goaded its firms to ensure rapid industrialization, thereby altering the global division of labor in its favor. Friedman himself would have rued these government policies, yet the tens of thousands of workers that pencil factories in China's employ would most likely have remained poor farmers if the government had not given market forces a nudge to get the industry off the ground. Given China's economic success, it is hard to deny the contribution made by the government's industrialization policies. Free market enthusiasts' place in the history of economic thought will remain secure. But thinkers like Friedman leave an ambiguous and puzzling legacy, because it is the interventionists who have succeeded in economic history, where it really matters. The Mercantilist Challenge. The history of economics is largely a struggle between two opposing schools of thought, liberalism and mercantilism. Economic liberalism, with its emphasis on private entrepreneurship and free markets, remains today's dominant doctrine. But its intellectual victory has blinded us to the great appeal and frequent success of mercantilist practices. In fact, mercantilism remains alive and well. And its continuing conflict with liberalism is likely to be a major force shaping the future of the global economy. Today, mercantilism is typically dismissed as an archaic and blatantly erroneous set of ideas about economic policy. And in their heyday, mercantilists certainly did defend some very odd notions, chief among which was the view that national policy ought to be guided by the accumulation of precious metals, gold and silver. Adam Smith's 1776 treatise, The Wealth of Nations, masterfully demolished many of these ideas. Smith showed, in particular, that money should not be confused for wealth. As he put it, the wealth of a country consists not in its gold and silver only, but in its lands, houses, and consumable goods of all different kinds. But it is more accurate to think of mercantilism as a different way to organize the relationship between the state and the economy. A vision that holds no less relevance today than it did in the 18th century. Mercantilist theorists such as Thomas Mann were in fact strong proponents of capitalism. They just propounded a different model than liberalism. The liberal model views the state as necessarily predatory and the private sector as inherently rent-seeking, so it advocates a strict separation between the state and private business. Mercantilism, by contrast, offers a corporatist vision in which the state and private business are allies and cooperate in pursuit of common objectives such as domestic economic growth or national power. The mercantilist model can be derided as state capitalism or cronyism, But when it works, as it has so often in Asia, the model's government-business collaboration or pro-business state quickly garners heavy praise. Lagging economies have not failed to notice that mercantilism can be their friend. Even in Britain, classic liberalism arrived only after the mid-19th century, that is, after the country had become the world's dominant industrial power. A second difference between the two models lies in whether consumer or producer interests are privileged. For liberals, consumers are king. The ultimate objective of economic policy is to increase households' consumption potential, which requires giving them unhindered access to the cheapest possible goods and services. Mercantilists, by contrast, emphasize the productive side of the economy. For them, a sound economy requires a sound production structure, and consumption needs to be underpinned by high employment at adequate wages. These different models have predictable implications for international economic policies. The logic of the liberal approach is that the economic benefits of trade arise from imports. The cheaper the imports, the better, even if the result is a trade deficit. Mercantilists, however, view trade as a means of supporting domestic production and employment, and prefer to spur exports rather than imports. Today's China is the leading bearer of the mercantilist torch, though Chinese leaders would never admit it. Too much opprobrium still attaches to the term. Much of China's economic miracle is the product of an activist government that has supported, stimulated, and openly subsidized industrial producers, both domestic and foreign. Although China phased out many of its explicit export subsidies as a condition of membership in the World Trade Organization, which it joined in 2001, mercantilism's support system remains largely in place. In particular, the government has managed the exchange rate to maintain manufacturers' profitability, resulting in a sizable trade surplus, which has come down recently. Moreover, export-oriented firms continue to benefit from a range of tax incentives. From the liberal perspective, these export subsidies impoverish Chinese consumers while benefiting consumers in the rest of the world. A study by the economists Fabrice Defevre and Alejandro Riaño of the University of Nottingham puts the losses to China at around 3% of Chinese income and gains to the rest of the world at around 1% of global income. From the mercantilist perspective, however, these are simply the costs of building a modern economy and setting the stage for long-term prosperity. As the example of export subsidies shows, the two models can coexist happily in the world economy. Liberals should be happy to have their consumption subsidized by mercantilists. Indeed, that, in a nutshell, is the story of the last six decades. A succession of Asian countries managed to grow by leaps and bounds by applying different variants of mercantilism. Governments in rich countries, for the most part, looked the other way, while Japan, South Korea, Taiwan, and China protected their home markets, appropriated intellectual property, subsidized their producers, and managed their currencies. We have now reached the end of this happy coexistence. The liberal model has become severely tarnished, owing to the rise in inequality and the plight of the middle class in the West, together with the financial crisis that deregulation spawned. Medium-term growth prospects for the American and European economies range from moderate to bleak. Unemployment will remain a major headache and preoccupation for policymakers, so mercantilist pressures will likely intensify in the advanced countries, too. As a result, the new economic environment will produce more tension than accommodation between countries pursuing liberal and mercantilist paths. It may also reignite long-dormant debates about the type of capitalism that produces the greatest prosperity. Economics hijacked. When the stakes are high, it is no surprise that battling political opponents use whatever support they can garner from economists and other researchers. This is what happened when conservative American politicians and European Union officials latched onto the work of two Harvard professors, Carmen Reinhart and Kenneth Rogoff, to justify their support of fiscal austerity. Reinhart and Rogoff had published a paper that appeared to show that public debt levels above 90% of GDP do significant damage to economic growth. The paper was criticized by three economists from the University of Massachusetts at Amherst, who argued their findings were brittle. They had found a relatively minor spreadsheet error, but more importantly, they charged that Reinhardt and Rogoff had made some questionable methodological assumptions that cast doubt on their results. Even though debt levels and growth seemed to be negatively correlated, the evidence for a stark 90% threshold was weak. And many others have argued that the correlation itself could be the result of a reverse causation, from low growth to high indebtedness, rather than the other way around. Reinhardt and Rogoff strongly contested accusations by many commentators that they were willing, if not willful, participants in a game of political deception. They defended their empirical methods and insisted that they are not the deficit hawks that their critics portrayed them to be. The Reinhardt-Rogoff affair was not just an academic quibble. Because the 90% threshold had become political fodder, its subsequent demolition also became politicized. Despite their protests, Reinhardt and Rogoff were accused of providing scholarly cover for a set of policies for which there was, in fact, limited supporting evidence. A similar criticism was leveled at a paper by two other economists, Alberto Alesina and Silvia Ardagna, which apparently showed that fiscal austerity could stimulate the economy, the opposite of the standard Keynesian presumption. This paper, too, had been influential in policy circles, until the austerity camp had to concede defeat under the weight of accumulating evidence to the contrary. Clearly, we can use better rules of engagement between economic researchers and policymakers. I discuss how economists should relate to the public in my book, Economics Rules. But one approach that does not work is for economists to second-guess how their ideas will be used or misused in public debate, and to shade their public statements accordingly. For example, Reinhardt and Rogoff might have downplayed their results, such as they were, in order to prevent them from being misused by deficit hawks. But few economists are sufficiently well attuned to have a clear idea of how the politics will play out. Moreover, when economists adjust their message to fit their audience, the result is the opposite of what is intended. They rapidly lose credibility. This is clearly what happened in the globalization debate, where such shading of research is established practice. For fear of empowering the protectionist barbarians, trade economists have been prone to exaggerate the benefits of trade and downplay its distributional and other costs. In practice, this often leads to their arguments being captured by interest groups on the other side. For example, global corporations that seek to manipulate trade rules to their own advantage. As a result, economists are rarely viewed as honest brokers in the public debate about globalization. A far better strategy for economists is to be open about the ambiguity and context specificity of most results in economics, to flaunt the diversity rather than hide it. Instead, as we'll see in the next chapter, economists' tendency is to celebrate consensus and rue discord, even when they should know better. Chapter 6. The Perils of Economic Consensus. The Initiative on Global Markets, based at the University of Chicago, periodically surveys a group of leading academic economists of varying political persuasions on the issues of the day. Despite the difference in the political orientation, there is often overwhelming consensus. For example, when the group was asked whether President Barack Obama's stimulus plan helped to reduce unemployment in the United States, the responses were virtually unanimous. Officially known as the American Recovery and Reinvestment Act of 2009, the plan entailed government spending of more than $800 billion on infrastructure, education, health, energy, tax incentives, and various social programs. Implemented in the midst of an economic crisis, it was the classic Keynesian response. 36 of the 37 top economists who responded to the survey said that the plan had been successful in its avowed objective of reducing unemployment. The University of Michigan economist Justin Wolfers cheered the consensus in his New York Times blog. The virulent public debate about whether fiscal stimulus works, he complained, has become totally disconnected from what experts know and agree on. Economists agree on many things that are often politically controversial. The Harvard economist Greg Mankiw listed some of them in 2009. The following propositions garnered support from at least 90% of economists: import tariffs and quotas reduce general economic welfare, rent controls reduce the supply of housing, floating exchange rates provide an effective international monetary system, the United States should not restrict employers from outsourcing work to foreign countries, and fiscal policy stimulates the economy when there is less than full employment. This consensus about so many important issues contrasts rather starkly with the general perception that economists rarely agree on anything. If all the economists were laid end to end, George Bernard Shaw famously quipped, they would not reach a conclusion. Frustrated by the conflicting and hedged advice that he was receiving from his advisers, President Dwight Eisenhower is said to have asked once for a one-handed economist. No doubt there are many public policy questions that economists debate vigorously. What should the top income tax rate be? Should the minimum wage be raised? Should the fiscal deficit be reduced by raising taxes or cutting spending? Do patents stimulate or impede innovation? On these and many other issues, economists tend to be good at seeing both sides of the issue, and I suspect that a survey on such questions would reveal little consensus. A consensus among economists can arise for both good and bad reasons. Sometimes a consensus is innocuous enough, as when you hear economists argue that one ignores the role of incentives at one's peril. Can anyone really disagree with that? Sometimes it is restricted to a particular episode and is based on evidence accumulated after the fact. Yes, the Soviet economic system was hugely inefficient. Yes, the Obama fiscal stimulus of 2009 did reduce unemployment. But when a consensus forms around the universal applicability of a specific model, the critical assumptions of which are likely to be violated in many settings, we have a problem. Consider some of the areas of widespread agreement that I listed before. The proposition that trade restrictions reduce economic welfare is certainly not generally valid, and it is violated when certain conditions, such as externalities or increasing returns to scale, are present. Moreover, it requires that economists make value judgments on distributional effects, which are better left to the electorate itself. Likewise, the proposition that rent controls reduce the supply of housing is violated under the conditions of imperfect competition, and the proposition that floating exchange rates are an effective system relies on assumptions about the workings of the monetary and financial system that have proved problematic. I suspect a poll today would find significantly less support for it. Consider other issues of the day. The widely held presumption that minimum wages are damaging to employment carries considerably less weight today because of mounting evidence showing mixed results. There are models under which minimum wages either do not reduce unemployment or increase it. Even in the case of Brexit, where the weight of both evidence and theory predicts adverse economic results, economists would have been well advised to emphasize their uncertainty over their confidence. Perhaps economists tend to agree that certain assumptions are more prevalent in the real world, or maybe they think that one set of models works better on average than another. Even so, as scientists, should they not adorn their endorsements with the appropriate caveats? Shouldn't they worry that categorical statements such as those before may prove to be misleading in at least some settings? The problem is that economists often confuse a model for the model. When that happens, a consensus is certainly not something to cheer about. Two kinds of mischief may then follow. First, there are errors of omission, cases in which blind spots in the consensus prevent economists from being able to see troubles looming ahead. A prominent example was the failure of economists to grasp the dangerous confluence of circumstances that produced the global financial crisis. As I argued earlier, the oversight was not due to the lack of models of bubbles, asymmetric information, distorted incentives, or bank runs. It was due to the fact that such models were neglected in favor of models that stressed efficient markets. Then there are the errors of commission, cases in which economists' fixation on one particular model of the world makes them complicit in the administration of policies whose failure could have been predicted ahead of time. Economists' advocacy of neoliberal Washington consensus policies and of financial globalization falls into this category. What happened in both cases is that economists overlooked serious second-best complications, such as learning externalities and weak institutions, which blunted the reforms and in some cases caused them to backfire. The peculiar science of economics. The firestorm over the Reinhardt-Rogoff analysis overshadowed what was in fact a salutary process of scrutiny and refinement of economic research. Reinhardt and Rogoff quickly acknowledged the spreadsheet mistake they had made. The dueling analyses clarified the nature of the data, their limitations, and the difference that alternative methods of processing them made to the results. Ultimately, Reinhardt and Rogoff were not that far apart from their critics on either what the evidence showed or what the policy implications were. So the silver lining in this fracas is that it showed that economics can progress by the rules of science. No matter how far apart their political views may have been, the two sides shared a common language about what constitutes evidence and, for the most part, a common approach to resolving differences. Economics, unlike the natural sciences, rarely yields cut-and-dried results. Economics is really a toolkit with multiple models, each a different, stylized representation of some aspect of reality. The contextual nature of its reasoning means that there are as many conclusions as potential real-world circumstances. All economic propositions are if-then statements. One's skill as an economic analyst depends on the ability to pick and choose the right model for the situation. Accordingly, figuring out which remedy works best in a particular setting is a craft rather than a science. One reaction I get when I say this is the following. How can economics be useful if you have a model for every possible outcome? Well, the world is complicated, and we understand it by simplifying it. A market behaves differently when there are many sellers than when there are a few. Even when there are a few sellers, the outcomes differ depending on the nature of strategic interactions among them. When we add imperfect information, we get even more possibilities. The best we can do is to understand the structure of behavior in each one of these cases, and then have an empirical method that helps us to apply the right model to the particular context we are interested in. So, we have one economics, many recipes, as the title of one of my books puts it. Unlike the natural sciences, economics advances not by newer models superseding old ones, but through a richer set of models that sheds ever brighter light at the variety of social experience. It is surprising, therefore, that very little research is devoted in economics to what might be called economic diagnostics, figuring out which, among multiple plausible models, actually applies in a particular real-world setting. Economists understand well the theoretical and empirical predicates of, say, Fama's or Shiller's models, but they lack systematic tools to determine conclusively whether it is one or the other that best characterizes Wall Street today or mortgage markets in 2007, for example. When they engage the real world, this leads them to render universal judgments rather than conditional ones, picking one model over the other instead of navigating among them as the circumstances require. The profession places a large premium on developing new models that shed light on as-yet-unexplained phenomena, but there seems little incentive for research that informs how appropriate models and remedies can be selected in specific contexts. My colleagues and I have brought such ideas to bear on problems of growth policy in developing countries, but clearly this ought to be part of a much more general research agenda. Over time, of course, good economists develop a knack for performing the needed diagnostics. Even then, the work is done instinctively and rarely becomes codified or expounded at any length. Unfortunately, empirical evidence in economics is rarely reliable enough to settle decisively a controversy characterized by deeply divided opinion, certainly not in real time. This is particularly true in macroeconomics, where the time series data are open to diverse interpretations. Those with strong priors in favor of financial market efficiency, such as Eugene Fama, for example, can continue to absolve financial markets from culpability for the crisis, laying the blame elsewhere. Keynesians and classical economists can continue to disagree on their interpretation of high unemployment. But even in microeconomics, where it is sometimes possible to generate precise empirical estimates using randomized controlled trials, those estimates apply only locally to a particular setting. The results must be extrapolated, using judgment and a lot of hand-waving, in order to be applied more generally. New economic evidence serves at best to nudge the views, a little here, a little there, of those inclined to be open-minded. One thing that experts know and that non-experts do not, the development economist Kaushik Basu has said, is that they know less than non-experts think they do. The implications go beyond not overselling any particular research result. Journalists, politicians, and the general public have a tendency to attribute greater authority and precision to what economists say than economists should really feel comfortable with. Unfortunately, economists are rarely humble, especially in public, and it does not help that what gets academic economists ahead in their careers is cleverness, not wisdom. Professors at top universities distinguish themselves not by being right about the real world, but by devising imaginative theoretical twists or developing novel evidence. If these skills also render them perceptive observers of real societies and provide them with sound judgment, it is hardly by design. So economics is both science and craft. Ironically, it is the neglect of the craft element, aiming to elevate economic status as a science, that occasionally turns it into snake oil. Discontent within economics. It should be no surprise, therefore, that economics has never been short of critics. Ever since the late 19th century, when economics, increasingly embracing mathematics and statistics, developed scientific pretensions, its practitioners have been accused of a variety of sins. The charges, including hubris, neglect of social goals beyond incomes, excessive attention to formal techniques, and failure to predict major economic developments, such as financial crises, have usually come from outsiders, or from a heterodox fringe. But lately, it seems that even the field's leaders are unhappy. Paul Krugman, a Nobel laureate who also writes a newspaper column, has made a habit of slamming the latest generation of models in macroeconomics for neglecting old-fashioned Keynesian truths. Paul Romer, one of the originators of New Growth Theory, has accused some leading names, including the Nobel laureate Robert Lucas, of what he calls mathiness, using math to obfuscate rather than clarify. Richard Thaler, a distinguished behavioral economist at the University of Chicago, has taken the profession to task for ignoring real-world behavior in favor of models that assume people are rational optimizers. And finance professor Luigi Zingales, also at the University of Chicago, has charged that his fellow finance specialists have led society astray by overstating the benefits produced by the financial industry. This kind of critical examination by the discipline's big names is healthy and welcome, especially in a field that has often lacked much self-reflection. But there is a disconcerting undertone to this new round of criticism that needs to be made explicit and rejected. Economics is not the kind of science in which there could ever be one true model that works best in all contexts. The point is not to reach a consensus about which model is right, as Romer puts it, but to figure out which model applies best in a given setting. And doing that will always remain a craft, or art, in Keynes's terms, not a science, especially when the choice must be made in real time. The social world differs from the physical world because it is man-made and hence almost infinitely malleable. So unlike the natural sciences, economics advances scientifically not by replacing old models with better ones, but by expanding its library of models, with each shedding light on a different social contingency. For example, we now have many models of markets with imperfect competition or asymmetric information. These models have not made their predecessors, based on perfect competition, obsolete or irrelevant. They have simply made us more aware that different circumstances call for different models. Similarly, behavioral models that emphasize heuristic decision-making make us better analysts of environments where such considerations may be important. They do not displace rational choice models, which remain the go-to tool in other settings. A growth model that applies to advanced countries may be a poor guide in developing countries. Models that emphasize expectations are sometimes best for analyzing inflation and unemployment levels. At other times, models with Keynesian elements will do a superior job. Jorge Luis Borges, the Argentine writer, once wrote a short story, a single paragraph, in fact, that is perhaps the best guide to the scientific method. In it, he described a distant land where cartography, the science of making maps, was taken to